Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Nerma Elbagir, Senior International Correspondent at CNN. Born in Sudan, she and her family moved to the UK when she was 3 years old. She graduated from the LSE and joined Reuters as a reporter in her home country before moving into broadcast journalism with More4News. Her first documentary, Meeting the Janjaweed, had unprecedented access to the Sudanese militia's leadership and found the first concrete evidence of the government's involvement with the Janjaweed. In 2011, Nerma joined CNN as an international correspondent based in London. Her main focus has been the Middle East and Africa, covering stories such as the conflict in Libya, violence against women and girls in Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia's military involvement in Yemen. She's also won a number of awards for her work, including Courage in Journalism and Excellence in International Reporting. Nerma, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've reported fearlessly from around the world. How have you adapted to the enforced coronavirus lockdown?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was almost kind of pre-quarantine, because about, 3 weeks before the lockdown, I managed to get into a car accident, which is just the most ridiculous car accident on earth.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I'm almost embarrassed by how ridiculous it was, because he was reversing, I wasn't looking. Both of us were equally as stupid. But I busted my neck and my ankle, and I'm discovering that ankles are basically the most finicky things on earth. So for about 3-4 weeks, I couldn't really leave the house without crutches. So I kind of felt like I emerged like, you know, there's always, in the zombie films, there's always one patient in a coma who suddenly awakens and the hospital's empty and they walk out into the streets. That's kind of how I felt the first time I walked out.
Literally, you spent all that time recuperating just to sort of take on the world. You open the door and then the world stopped.
It's like, but no, so I still can't really put any weight on it. So if you are going to, as a foreign correspondent, be absolutely homebound, this is possibly the best time to do it. But at the same time, it also feels like the worst possible time to do it, because you see the trends, you see the patterns coming, and every kind of fiber of your being wants to get on the next available plane, where planes are still flying. But I don't know if there is anyone possibly more useless than me right now. The thought of a foreign correspondent on crutches being unleashed into capitals of the world ravaged by the coronavirus is just, I mean, it's absolutely farcical. So I'm going to stay home. I've got another 2 months of rehab, which I just, it's probably, I've actually realized this is the longest I've been in one place since I started working as a journalist, like without any travel. So it's both horrifying and illuminating in equal measure.
There's an argument to be said, though, that if you're going to have a busted ankle and you can't leave the house, you might as well have it during lockdown, because you wouldn't want to have two separate periods of being housebound. At least you've combined two birds with one stone, aren't you?
Yes, yes. Although there is an argument to be said that when you're locked down, possibly don't do it at the time when everybody else is stuck at home with you. I've kind of started encouraging, gently and then violently, people to go on those, you know, hourly walks, and I have to stay, you don't, maybe you leave and come back. But yes, we surprisingly all still like each other, which is amazing.
Are you at your happiest then, when you're sort of out in the field, you're actually there, you know you're doing something to camera and you get into the story?
Not the camera bit, because the camera bit is always, I think every correspondent will probably tell you, that the most fraught period is from the moment you land in country till the moment you get that first piece to camera, that first sequence in the can. So I don't miss that. I miss being out there in extraordinary places with just the most extraordinary people. Yeah, I'm quite extreme in that I'm both, when I'm in the field, I'm kind of extremely in the field. And then when I'm home, I'm extreme homebody. I can happily not leave the house, and it is being tested currently, but I can happily just sit there in jogging bottoms, surrounded by my sisters and my, you know, I have a 3-year-old, which obviously leads to insanity and hilarity in equal measure. So I'm both really, really, really happy when I'm somewhere amazing. And it's always kind of, I don't know, 1 a.m. and you're looking out somewhere and, I don't know, you're driving through this extraordinary country and you've just spoken to amazing people and you're somewhere that most people will never see in their entire lives. But then I'm also equally happy on the sofa watching RuPaul's Drag Race with my sisters. It's the extremes, I guess.
I'm the same. My wife says I'm either on or off. I'm either sort of working 16 hours a day, or I'm just sitting in my underpants watching terrible television like you, with my brain gloriously switched off.
Yes,
for five
yes,
or 6 hours.
Yes. I just want to stress again, I'm wearing jogging bottoms. Just in case
well, it's an audio podcast, so our listeners can take you at your yeah, as I say, and I mentioned to this before we started, actually, this is only the third one we've done down the line. Normally we do them face to face, so that prevents people doing them in underwear.
Well, I think you cheat, because I think in general regional accents are perceived by listeners as warm, and you have a really nice voice, so I feel like
it's very
you're kind of getting out ahead.
Well, I did warn you at the beginning before we started the tape that I am susceptible to flattery, so you certainly do very well. Now listen, we've got absolutely tons to get through. I want to talk about your career and your job, and there's all manner of questions I wanted to ask you, but I wanted to ask, continuing the quarantine theme, you memorably reported from the 2014 Ebola epidemic from inside Liberia's quarantine zones. How different is our response in the West to the pandemic? How is it different, you know, from the one on our own doorstep?
That is actually something that I've been thinking a lot about, and trying to get my head around the discomfort that I feel and the message that it says about the value of different lives in terms of even the public reaction to the risks that journalists are taking. There seems to be, when you take the pulse of the public, there seems to be a real discomfort about journalists being inside intensive care units, being inside hospitals, filming police officers, whether or not the police are policing effectively, whether or not the police are being overzealous. And there, you know, and there's a lot to actually be unpacked about the measures that this government has given itself. The fact that this government has not in the past been very honest or completely transparent. They weren't transparent about the timeline of Boris Johnson's illness. They weren't transparent about the timeline of the testing. They didn't take the disease seriously. And there are really serious questions that need to be asked. The public doesn't seem comfortable with us asking them. There's this real kind of sense of get out of the way. But when it was far from our doorsteps, and I say this in the US and in the UK, I think in the US people are becoming more comfortable as it has become so apparent how botched the governmental response has been in the US. People are more comfortable with journalists asking questions and kind of getting in the way. Not that we are in the way, because we are, you know, we're part and parcel of a functioning democracy. But I feel really uncomfortable by this sense of when it is far away, when it's not on our doorstep, that's fine. Get in the way all you want. Tell us. We need to know what's happening. Take those risks. Even just the calculations that go into the risks that are being taken seem to feel different. You know, we went back into the Ebola zone two or three times, and we went, and it was on a voluntary basis. You didn't have to go if you didn't want to. I think it was me. I went in twice. David McKenzie went in once. Sanjay Gupta, our chief medical correspondent, went in once. And then Elizabeth Cohen went in once. It was, but that was it in terms of the people who were willing to go. And that's absolutely fine. But once we went, there was a sense that we are grown-ups. We know how to mitigate risk. We took security assessments seriously, and the risk was astronomical. Now, when it comes to this coverage, it being at home seems to completely change the calculus, and I find myself really uncomfortable with that.
I mean, coronavirus is rampaging through Africa at the moment. Do you think Western media coverage overlooks the global impact, frankly, in a kind of selfish lens?
Yes, absolutely. I think we continue to center our stories. And I think again and again, and this is why I am always grateful when we do get recognition for the work we do, because it sends the message that there is no hierarchy to stories, and that stories are stories, people are people, and we shouldn't privilege anyone's pain over the others. And when we focus in on our pain, and when we focus in on the pain and the suffering and the discomfort of people who look like us, look, I'm not naive. I know what makes a news story, and what makes a news story is what is new and what is unexpected. It is unexpected that people should be dying in Western developed countries in their tens of thousands. It is sad, it is horrible, and it is unexpected. And of course, that leads the news, and the ways in which our infrastructure and our institutions failed. Yeah, absolutely. But we also need to be starting to pivot and prepare ourselves. The head of the World Food Programme a day or two ago was warning of famines of biblical proportions. Now, the time to be ringing those alarm bells is now, before you get to the famines of biblical proportions. And we are part and parcel of that early warning system. So we, you know, we've had internal discussions within CNN about how do we get to Syria? How do we think about Yemen effectively? How do we think about going into those places safely and maintaining the same standard of, for safety and security for the teams that we're deploying to those areas as the teams that we're deploying in Spain or in Asia? And I think that's where CNN is at its best, because we are used to deploying in a global way, but also we have a very much an internationalist mentality. So we are able to think about Japan on CNN International and our coverage of Japan the same way that we think of London. But I think it is very important to state categorically that we haven't, none of us in the media, I think, are pivoting fast enough for the story, the next wave of this story, and that is the impact. Because in Africa, a lot of the data is being taken quite lightly because Africa and the Middle East are behind the wave. So the numbers that you're seeing don't match from a from an actual just numbers perspective with the horrible numbers that you're seeing in Europe and America, right? But the reality is that ultimately that's because they're in a different part of the wave. So we don't know what's coming down the road. But what we do know is that when you have people who have no access to clean water, who are living day to day or are subsistence farming, that the, we actually might be in a horrible situation where the lockdown kills more people than the disease. And the only way you mitigate that is through global leadership, it's through aid, and it's through people realizing that that disaster is coming. And what I have found, what we have found, is that governments tend to not want to do something internationally when they're putting out a fire on their own doorstep, unless public opinion and public pressure is in place. And that's where we have to step in as journalists.
Sometimes I get frustrated when I see correspondents covering Africa that they're sometimes kind of perpetuating the African sort of media stereotype. I mean, I've worked in Africa. There's obviously areas of extreme poverty, but there's, you know, I've worked in sort of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, which is in many ways indistinguishable from any other city. It's quite prosperous in many ways as suburbs. Yeah. But you know, I worked for a charity there, a non-profit, and they said that if they try to raise money back in the West with, you know, images of Tanzania and Dar es Salaam looking like it does, it doesn't perpetuate the stereotype of the emaciated, starving child that's going to increase the sort of revenue dollars. And I've heard horror stories from producers working in Africa where the newsrooms back in London will say, can you sort of, you know, make this look more African. The kids that were welcoming the politician there were wearing shoes and it just didn't sit right with us. Can you get them to do it again without shoes? I mean, clearly is that on the way, and is that kind of practice on the way out? Are people starting to become more aware of it? It's something that deeply concerns me.
I think it changes when you have people of African origin sitting in the room to say, okay, yes, of course, when we cover Nigeria, we have to cover the stories in the north. But at the same time, our digital content, our features content needs to be reflective of the rich culture, the extraordinary wealth, but also we need to not be afraid to call out the disparities between that wealth. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think for so long, those stereotypes were kind of perpetuated unchallenged, that now they become a weapon to bludgeon the media with. So it is right and proper for us to say that Nigeria, a country which consumes the most champagne outside of France, should not have that massive disparity between wealth. And if we're telling a story about Nigeria's poverty, then it's right and proper that we reflect that. That's not the entirety of our coverage. And that's what happens when you have bureaus in country. You know, the BBC does an extraordinary job with its local language services. They have a bureau there. We have a Stephanie Basari, who's British Nigerian, is based for us out there. That's what happens when you put resources in country, that you can show the totality of that picture. And also when you have diversity in your newsrooms, where you have somebody who's able to say, that's embarrassing. Let's not make ourselves look stupid. Please don't say that. I mean, we had that a lot, for example, whenever we're covering a story of women in the Middle East or women in the Arab world. And it's always, look at this amazing woman that somehow has fought back against the cultural shackles. Now, for example, in Sudan, the first member of parliament in the entire Arab world was a Sudanese woman, Fatma Ahmed Ibrahim. So when we're covering the revolution and people are lauding the extraordinary role that Sudanese women played in it, it is important to have somebody who can say, okay, first of all, let's not embarrass ourselves by making it sound like these poor women were dragged out of huts to the front lines of the revolution. You know, these are educated women who were frustrated because they were educated and still subsumed within this Islamist, Islamo-fascist ideology that was oppressing women much more than it was oppressing men, even though they were educated and they were capable. And that was proven by the fact that women were able to lead this revolution. It just allows us to tell a nuanced story, but it also allows us to say, but then we still are able to call out the fact that the government used rape as a weapon of war, because culturally, that still in so many parts of the country is a way to suppress women and to bring women back in the homes, because women's honor is still seen as communal property in a lot of the parts of the Middle East and a lot of the parts of the Arab world and Africa. Like, I think it is just that the only way you can tell a nuanced story is to have representation and to understand the culture that you're reporting on.
I'd like to actually carry on discussing some of the stories that you've covered. I mean, your investigations have exposed shocking practices. I know, memorably, you went undercover to witness a human slave auction in Libya, which sparked a global outcry. Could you tell us how you approached that story?
So that story was years in the making. We actually, Raja Razik and I, the producer, who she's one of my closest friends, she's Palestinian-American, the producer that worked with us on that, she had left CNN, she was our senior Middle East producer. She came in freelance, because she and I had essentially, in 2014, when the migrant wave was coming into Europe, been covering that story from different ends of it. So she had gone into Libya, and she'd gone into a warehouse where migrants were housed, and she was covering the Syrian story. And what was extraordinary to her is, as bad as the conditions where the Syrians were kept, the Syrians were still considered to be going first class, so to speak, because they had more money. And she was posing as a Syrian to report out that story. And when she asked, what on earth is happening in that corner where the African migrants are? And she was told, no, don't worry. Those are the Africans. They'll be below deck. They won't bother you. And that really stuck in her mind. And she still had those contacts. And I was in Italy in a reception center. And we were doing a story about Egyptian children who were being smuggled by their, essentially trafficked by their parents because they were all underaged, but willingly smuggled. And the mafia kind of links to that and the ways that they were then exploited when they got to Italy. But this Eritrean migrant came up to me and said to me, I don't want to be on camera. I don't want my name recorded, but I want you to know that men come into these warehouses, and while we're waiting to go on the ship, they get to pick us, they auction us off, like this is he's strong, he'll do, and you go out and you're put out to labor. And we both found that we had different parts of this puzzle, and it was just this idea of, how do we ever get close to this story, given the insecurity in Libya, given the, how do you get anywhere near that? It just felt impossible. And but we kept kind of, every time we'd speak to somebody, we'd make a note of who they were, and we were keeping this list of contacts, which is almost unheard of, right? Because we're doing the breaking news, we're doing the on the day, and you don't really have time to think about anything else. But we just kind of became almost obsessed with it. And I went off, I got pregnant, and because we live in a civilized country, I was able to take maternity leave. So I was off for 8.5 months. And in the way that first-time mums do, I decided that, well, I mean, I'm going to be on maternity leave, right? I'm not going to be busy. So let's figure out how to make this story work. So it was just literally having the time. And it's completely banal, but when you have your first child, everybody tells you that you'll want to keep everything, all these mementos. And you have a little baby box, and you have a little baby book that says, oh, he breastfed this time, this amount of time, or he did this, or he did that. And I actually was putting it away for Ali. And I looked through the margins, and I realized that I clearly was on these calls or researching, because it's endless and boring, and you're constantly feeding, or at least I was. And I had little notes of like, oh, 8 auctioned off his leg. I mean, we were just completely obsessed with it. I have kept the book. I'm not sure I'll ever show it to him because it doesn't speak well of me. So I was still on maternity leave. And then the International Organization of Migration appeared before the Security Council. And they had this extraordinary story of this bus in Sabha where it was becoming so open that they were just taking them off the bus and auctioning them off, just in the desert. And then the chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, also came in front of the Security Council and asked for their remit to be expanded, and it wasn't. And that's why I think for me, when people always say, well, you broke the story, we didn't break the story. We just found the evidence that was undeniable. Everybody knew this was happening, and nobody wanted to deal with the ramifications of what it would mean at a time when you had and still have this huge populist wave sweeping through Europe. What does it mean to humanize these migrants? What does it mean to acknowledge that the policy of blocking them in Libya wasn't just not working, but was knowingly creating this environment of medieval cruelty? So we, and Raja's extraordinary, and she's one of my favorite people in the world. Raja and Alex Platt, who's the photojournalist who I've since worked with all over the world, and is also one of my closest friends. And I think you could never do it with a team that you weren't incredibly close to. We went to Tripoli. I came back from maternity leave. I went to Iraq for 2 weeks, came back, and we managed through our contacts to get the footage that you see right at the beginning of the piece that was filmed on the iPad. That was the clincher for us, because he said, there's this auction, I'm going to go, and I'm going to tell them that, he said, I'm going anyway. You know, obviously you have all these thoughts that go through your mind about the security and the people that you're dealing with, but he kept trying to explain to us that this is so out of the open, this is so without shame, that there is no risk, because nobody thinks that there are any ramifications to doing this. And you can see that in the footage right at the beginning, because he turns out they're completely normal. And they say to him, why are you here? And so actually he, at the time, in the spur of the moment, said to them, I'm here because there are sellers who want to buy. And they said, okay, well, do you want to film then? And that's why that video is so clear, because he pulled out his iPad, and we got that video end of August. We then, you know, we figured out the area, we did all the verification, just, we trusted him completely, but we also wanted to make sure that we could go back to our bosses and say, this is what it is. And then it was just, I mean, it was at the time, the head of CNN International, I spoke to Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, who was like, well, we have to do this. If we can do this, we have to. So that was really helpful, because when you say to someone, we want to go and undercover in a slave auction, it doesn't sound very clever. It doesn't sound, but we...
Sounds
we,
dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound doable, but we mapped it out. And our argument to my boss, Debs Rayner, who's just wonderful and has worked in Africa extensively and was set up the Indie Fund at Channel 4 News, and so is very good at doing these small scale, small footprint, high risk, high reward kind of stories. That's just how her mind works. So we were very lucky. We said the whole point of this story is it's out in the open. And if it's out in the open, then we can get to it. If it's not out in the open, then it's not as egregious, then it's not as big as a story as we thought it was. And therefore, you know, no harm, no foul. We go to Libya and we come back. But if it's the story that we think it is, which is that these are just happening, then we can get it safely. So we went, Raja and I, the Libyans, much like Sudan, are very mixed. So you have the south where they're mixed with African tribes, and in the north, they're much more kind of Arab and the kind of the remnants of the Romans. And their Arabic accent is very close to mine in Sudan. So it was, and I regularly knew from having worked in Libya that I was often mistaken for a Libyan. Also, there are a lot of Sudanese in Libya. There are lots of Palestinians. It's somewhere that's very much a crossroads for a lot of immigrant waves from across the Arab world. So I was never going to stick out. And that was a huge point of trust for my boss, was to know that I had that understanding, that I knew, that we knew what we were talking about. So we went and we extraordinarily were able to join one of our contacts and his family, his wife, his daughters. Wow. They're the ones who drove us cross country. Yeah, we had a Libyan security team following behind, but they took an enormous risk, because when the militias or whatever look in a car and it's full of women, then the way Libyan society works, we were able to exploit the horrors of the patriarchy. They just waved us on. And so we got to our location and we went. And it was exactly as you saw it, except for the fact that my hidden camera didn't work. It's the worst experience of my life. It worked up until the point where you see me get out of the car, and then it just died. So then in subsequent investigations, I have, you know, like we're carrying 18 of those. It just, I am not, it was just the worst, the longest moments of my life were my camera.
Horrendous, because you know you can't go back and get it again, yeah. Can you? It's why you see politicians when they give the big speech from the podium that they've got two microphones clipped to their blouse or their suit, because one of them is not going to work, even the fact it was tested 50 times.
Yes. It is the most superficial and the most important, like, just, is. It was so funny because a lot of other journalists have said to me, oh, that was such a great shot. How, you know, it was a real risk to have the primary camera be the one that was on you and kind of give you a vantage point. And I'm just always like, that wasn't a primary camera. I wish we could pretend, because immediately it was fake news. Immediately it was, well, President Trump said CNN is fake news. And, you know, there was just this, you know what, understandable wave of disbelief from people who felt, whether in the kind of the Libyan political sphere or broadly in the Arab world, or, you know, in North Africa, or, you know, even people who constantly want to undermine what journalists do, that this can't be real, because if it's real, it means we have to act. And so if we really had thought about it, we always, I mean, I knew my voice would be on camera, but it was a real lesson for us in hindsight, first of all, to have 20, 40 different cameras. But secondly, you always, you know, you worry as, especially as a TV correspondent, about the narcissism or the perceptions of narcissism, of always being in the shot. You can't always be in the shot, but for key evidentiary shots like that, you have to be able to place yourself. And that was a really good lesson for us. And I you know, and it's one I kind of carried through with me. But in, I mean, what I kind of remember from that moment is almost being two people. So there was the journalist that was thinking, they're bringing them out. Where am I standing? Where's Raja standing? How long can we stay in here? They're getting uncomfortable. How long before one of them points one of those guns at us? How long do we have? Did we get it? The floodlights are really bright. Are they going to be backlit? Like all these ridiculous questions. And then there was the person who was thinking, I need to know what happened.
What's happening here from a human level?
Yeah. But also how far can we go in terms of asking those questions about these people? How do we make sure that we do the human thing and try and find them afterwards? And how do we do that without risking each other? So there's that, there's the shot in the story where you see me in the open doorway talking to the auctioneer, and the contact was opening the car door, like he was starting to panic. And Raja, who is all of, and I'm going to get this wrong and she's going to hate me, but 5'2", 5'3", and I'm 6'1". So there's like all of 5'3" Raja trying to kind of hold our contact in and understandably in place. And I'm still in the door and the auctioneer is essentially starting to treat me like a crazy person. Because it's the middle of the night, what kind of moron is asking these questions? But I just, we couldn't have left without knowing who these people are. How do we find, like, just give me something. So I ask where they were from and do they speak Arabic? Can I go back? Because a lot of them do, because of having traveled up to Libya, having picked up Arabic. And I use the cover story that I'm looking for a Sudanese. So he knows that in a different circumstance, someone like me would have been being auctioned off. So I was saying, I was looking for a Sudanese who had migrated. And also that depends, obviously, you know, I sound very Khartoum, I sound very educated, I sound like a city girl. He was treating me the way he would treat somebody that he perceives in that way. And I was exploiting that. But the reality is, if I had an accent from Darfur, who are most of the people who, because of the horrors in Darfur, have had to suffer the migratory route, he would happily have sold me. So that whole conversation is kind of carrying on. And I'm thinking those things. And I'm also thinking, But we can't get in that car without having something to try and find these people. And Raja stayed with me. You can hear her in the background going, she has a very distinctive high-pitched voice that I tease her about. But you can hear her saying, no, namaste, we stay. And then we got in the car. And the thing that we didn't show is that we did manage to get some of those guys that were auctioned off to meet us at the safe house, but the house we were staying at. But they were so traumatized that they couldn't believe that we wanted to help them. So we were trying to give them food, we were trying to give them money, and I just kept saying, give me a name, give me a number, while obviously not exposing ourselves, because we then had to spend the night there. We couldn't travel back into the city overnight. And I knew they must have, they knew they spoke Arabic, because one of them responded in Arabic during the auction. And there was nothing we could do. We couldn't help them because they didn't believe that we wanted to help. And Raja and I took the decision that they could not give informed consent in that moment. They didn't know who we were. We just felt that everything had been taken from them. That at the auction, we could make an argument for why we were there, but they just felt like once we had seen and spoken to them and explained to them that we were trying to help, and they had rejected our help. And to be fair, they wouldn't have stopped us filming, but it just felt like we got what we needed. We didn't need to take anything more from them.
Do you ever fear for your personal safety in these encounters? I mean, I was reading up, doing a bit of research, and I read how you went undercover reporting children for sale in Nigeria. And you were even offered two for $500, as I recall. But these are incredibly dangerous escapades.
I'm going to sound like a crazy person, and God forbid my mother hear this podcast. But in the moment, I'm just most afraid that we're not going to get what we came in to get. Because by that point, you have risked everybody's life. You have given the people who have given you that access hope, and you have allowed for the risks that they have taken to get you to that place. I think I'm just so, I don't know, there's no way of saying this without sounding a little bit broken in the head, but I just don't ever really get scared. And by the way, I'm a coward. I don't like big dogs.
Doesn't sound like it.
No, I am in my day-to-day life. I used to be really scared of dogs because I got mauled when I was really young, but I've gotten better. But I'm not, you know, like if a Doberman ran up to me, would I be super keen? Not necessarily.
But I think it's allowable and forgivable that you've got some kind of compensatory cowardice to sort of counterbalance the fearlessness. I mean, clearly, you know.
I don't know that it's compensating. I think by that point, you kind of also, I mean, we mitigate risk. You know, we have so many conversations. And at that point, it's kind of out of your hands. You know, we don't go in, like even in Libya, we had a local security team of Libyans that were further out on the parameter. So we kind of sat down and mapped it out with our boss. And okay, what's the worst thing that can happen? Worst thing that can happen is somebody takes a gun and shoot us. You can't mitigate against that. Second worst thing is that we get kidnapped and we're taken to a second location. So, okay, how do we mitigate against that? So we do think these things through, you know, in real detail. And I don't know whether that helps or whether just the focus helps. But also, I think, you know, when you go into those places, the most important thing is the people you're with. And I work with Roger Razik, the producer in Libya. I work with Barbara Avantides, who's our senior producer in London, Alex Platt. Lillian Laposa was my producer in Nairobi, Fabs Mohiri. These are people I have known for years and love. So I get to work with people who make me laugh, that I trust. And we game out in terms of, you know, like just doing almost game theory models of, I don't mean to sound flip by saying game, but you know, you kind of, you go through all the different iterations of the scenarios and then you get on the plane.
And you get on with it.
Yeah. And I think it's also incredible. Really easy being the person on the plane. I think that's the easiest part. The toughest part is being the person back home. So Debs, who in addition to being my boss, is also someone I'm really close to. She's the person I feel pissy for because She honestly, the day when we finally called her to say we were out, she said she had done, she's based in Atlanta. She's our head of news gathering. She had done laps of Piedmont Park in Atlanta. Like she couldn't sit in one place. And I think that is, I think that for the commissioning editor, I have nothing but respect, because they don't get the fun. they get a little bit of the accolades, but they don't get to be the person out there who gets told, oh, wow, that amazing thing you did. And they get the absolute shitty part of sitting at home thinking, what have I done? I have to wait for these people to get back on a plane.
I think it's still safer to be back at home in the office. They can make a cup of tea whenever they like. There's all manner of perks, in my view. But I do take your point. You get the glory, I suppose, if you can call it that. But you certainly get the journalistic credit because, frankly, you're the journalist. You're the one in theatre doing it. I wanted to talk about, you were the first international journalist to report from Chibok, the Nigerian village from which, was it 250 schoolgirls were kidnapped by Boko Haram in 2014? I mean,
yeah, that must have been
incredible. Two years after the abduction, you were able to secure proof of life video for some of the girls as well. I mean, tell us about that whole thing. It's amazing.
So I think that's one of the situations where we were really lucky, because I do think success begets success, in the sense that people trust you and they see the impact of the work. And, you know, and that's one of the amazing things about CNN. You know, it just, the platform has extraordinary reach, both domestically in the US and internationally. So when you ask people to take these risks with you or to share things with you in that way, also Stephanie Busari, who was the first point of contact for that video, is a great argument journalistically for why you should always stay in touch with your contact. So she had stayed in touch with all of those people that she had met, that we had met. She was based out of Abuja for digital for us. And she stayed in contact with them. And it was me, Nick Migwey, who's one of our Nairobi-based cameramen, and Lillian Laposo. And again, it was one of those things where it was on a voluntary-only basis. And we knew the Nigerian government was lying. We absolutely knew they were lying. We knew they hadn't mobilized anything or anyone because of the way that the population dynamics work between North and South, because the North is largely Muslim and the presidency at the time was held by a Christian. And also they're poor and it's not where the resources are. And they didn't care. So what? So we knew they were lying. And I actually, I'm making myself sound like somebody who's constantly out on injury, sound like a footballer. But I actually was at home. I'd torn my ACL on the coming back from Somalia into Kenya. And I'd been off for 2 months. And Chibok, the abduction had happened. And I'd gotten a call saying, well, obviously, you're rehabbing. That's fine. And then I'd gotten another call going, hey, completely voluntary. And I was like, yes. And I called Laposo and Migwey, and a story like that has to be opted. And we traveled up, and the only thing we hadn't really thought about was a car accident. So we get into a car accident because everybody's crazed and driving, not us, but on the road driving insanely. So then we had to stop in the heart of Boko Haram territory at the time, the one place that we were told not to stop. And I'm in like full abaya, trying to be inconspicuous. But we have one of our security, local Nigerian security guys, had a horrible injury where we were worried that he'd broken something in his neck. He was fine in the end, thankfully. But we had to get him into this regional podunk hospital, which luckily had an X-ray machine and was able to stabilize him. And I'm doing the one thing I'm not supposed to do, which is be visible. And it was one of those really lovely moments where you always, I just feel like, you know, I feel like it's like a streetcar named Design. A journalist, we're always reliant on the kindness of strangers. And the head matron was signing him in. And she said, well, I need all of your details and I need your ID. And I had my Sudanese passport, which at the time said housewife, because you had to put your professional on your passport. And I'd managed to kind of swizz it, so it said housewife. So I hand over my passport and she looked at me and she said, you're not a housewife. And I was like, but aren't we all in a way really housewives? And she was like, I'm gonna not record your name. I'm gonna put this under the patient, because who knows who comes in and looks at our registry. And then we waited another half hour for another car, and we kept traveling. And I just think that's one of the lovely things about digital, is that you can tell those kind of stories. But I just think, you know, we are so centered as the correspondents, as the journalists, you know, the correspondent, the producer, the Western team that flies in. And you very rarely hear these stories about the ways in which our jobs are made possible. So anyway, we get to Chibok. Again, the other thing that we were categorically not to do was to overnight in Chibok. So I've already had to call my boss, Debs, who's like, oh my God, can you walk? We're all fine. Okay, right. Well, how's your knee? Fine. Right. We get to Chibok. Our security guys and the police escort that we had been able to kind of, through a combination of shaming and begging and contacts, convinced to escort us to Chibok. And they hadn't actually been there because it was still so dangerous. They turn around and they say to us, you have to spend the night. Boko Haram have cut off the road. So I then have to make the second worst phone call, I would say, possibly in my career. The first one was having to call my boss and then be told, well, actually, this, you know, you have to speak to Tony, who's wonderful, but is, used to be the head of CNN International and is like the gruffest northerner in the world, and explain to him how, what has happened. And he was wonderful. He was just like, I'm just really worried. And I was like, look, we want to do this. We want to keep going. And he was like, okay, then I'm going to trust you and we're going to do this. So I'd already said, trust me, we're going to get there. We're going to be fine. We're going to do this. And we get there. And then I'm told, you have to stay the night. So I have to then make the second worst phone call and say, you know, the thing that you said not to do, which was in and out, don't overstay your welcome. Don't leave yourself vulnerable. Well, we're now being told.
I'm going to be doing that. Yeah, absolutely.
That yeah. Actually it's worst if we do that. So surprise.
Well, rules are there to be meant to be broken. They're there to be broken.
And absolutely, it was the right call. We were safer there. The worst thing would have been, and obviously he was wonderful, and my boss was wonderful, obviously, because they're sensible humans. But you've just kind of put your credibility on the line by saying, this is it. What else can go wrong? But obviously there's a secret part of my soul that's like, I now get to spend the night and actually do this justice. There was the little part of me, the journalist, that was like, this is amazing. But obviously denied. I was like, well, you know, this is just terrible. And in an ideal world, none of us would want this to happen. But you tell any journalist that they can, you know, film to their heart's content and really get into the story. And I do think that that was part of the reason why the films that we brought out from there had so much impact, because we had the time to paint you a picture of these girls and their families. I think first and foremost, the fact that right from the beginning, everybody spoke about them as schoolgirls was the right choice. And I'm sad to say, going back to your point about the perpetuation of stereotypes, I'm sad to say that that's not always the choice that's made.
Yes.
So if they'd come out and said, these 200 something girls from this village in the north of Nigeria that you've never heard of have been kidnapped, most people would have gone, yeah, but I guess that's their daily life, right? But once yes,
they almost so what?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but you know, in some random village in the north of Nigeria, that's what happens, right? But once you call them schoolgirls, then suddenly, oh, well, my little girl goes to school, my neighbor's little girl, my sister's little girl. Suddenly they're someone, their parents are people whose pain you can empathize with. And we found these two mothers who were best friends and their daughters were best friends. And they told us how these girls, the reason that they were still at school was because they were the brightest and the best. They were the ones that their families thought were going to be the doctors and the teachers. They were going to lift this entire community out of poverty. So there was another layer to this tragedy. And so suddenly you understood that they weren't, hey, what, whatever, another African kid goes missing. Isn't that just, I mean, it's sad, but that's kind of part and parcel of life, right, in Africa. But no, these were people who had dreams and had done the right thing. They'd sent their daughters to school, even though these appalling extremists had wanted to stop it. They had risked everything, including their daughters' lives. And suddenly you see these people and you see these girls. And I just feel like the lesson that that taught me as a journalist, but I think us as a network, is that there are all these truisms. Nobody cares about Africa. Nobody cares about African stories. News is what's new. And what's, you know, violence and conflict isn't new in Africa. But then the lesson for me was that that meant we weren't doing our jobs. If I don't allow you to see yourself and your friends and your neighbors in these people and in their stories, then that's not your failing. Your lack of empathy is not your failure, it's mine, because I haven't done my job.
That's a really interesting take, because as you said earlier, human suffering is human suffering. Why should you have to label them as schoolgirls just to evoke a sympathy response, which a human being should have for any other human being, wherever they are in the world, that's suffering? I mean, I understand the pragmatic reality and why you have to do it, but do you sometimes get disheartened from time to time, almost at the nature of humanity, that you have to rely on things like that just to drive home the what should be a very obvious point, that they're fellow human beings?
No, I think because we have so many competitors for our attention. And I think it's very natural. When I rail against that hierarchy of suffering, I am railing against it institutionally, that this is something that we as a profession should reckon with. What message does it send when we take on this truism as scripture and say, well, people don't care about people far from home, so why bother engage them? Or people don't care about Syria. You know, Wa'ad al-Khatib proved that wasn't true. People really cared about Syria because they saw themselves in this beautiful young woman who stayed and documented the reality of her life. So we institutionally need to ask ourselves, well, what happens when we take responsibility rather than make excuses and put the blame on the audience? My job is to tell a story. If I tell a story and it's a boring story, whose fault is that? If you walk out of a cinema halfway through the film because, you know, it wasn't worth your 15 quid to sit there, whose fault is that? I understand what you mean on an existential level, but I think it also lets us off the hook. It lets us off the hook in terms of our own biases as well and the ways that we view this world. Because if you can't humanize those people, then you have no business telling their story.
How much has your background influenced your journalism? You were born in Sudan and your father founded the El Khartoum newspaper, did he not? Wasn't he jailed for a period? Did that inspire you to always want to be a journalist? What's the origin story?
Oh my gosh, you make me sound like a superhero. I love it. So my grandfather was a journalist as well. My grandfather was part of the anti-colonial movement, the independence movement in Sudan. And his brother, who brought my mother up, was also a publisher. So that's on my mother's side, and then on my father's side as well. And my brother has an extraordinary production company that we worked with when we were in Sudan, mainly because I, you know, at the time reporting in Sudan carried a death sentence. And as perverse as it sounded, I kind of felt more comfortable risking my own family's life than somebody else's life. But I think part of it is that I grew up in a family where I could see that journalism made a difference. So my father was actually jailed before I was born. He was jailed, he was kidnapped from Egypt and extradited back to Sudan when my mum was pregnant with me. And then he was in jail on and off till I was 3, which is why we came to the UK. He has asthma, he developed a respiratory illness. So he was released to go to the UK. And then they went back, which it's why my history in terms of living here and living in the Middle East, living in Egypt, spending a bit of time in Saudi Arabia as well, is so kind of patchwork. Because every time we'd have brief moments of democracy, my father was home. So I didn't get a British passport until 2014. So I'm a dual citizen. I very much think of myself as culturally Sudanese first and foremost. And then London, England is probably the most stable home I've ever had. So I think of myself as both, but I kind of never really was here for long enough to fully think of myself as Anglo-Sudanese rather than Sudanese-British, if you see what I mean. So we went back again when I was 8, when there was a brief 5 years of democracy. And my father founded his newspaper then. But he'd been working for a newspaper called Al Arab here in Britain. And then he went home. And it was amazing. It was just this extraordinary free-for-all. And we actually had a tabloid press, which was extraordinary in and of itself for such a conservative country. And then I remember my father got on the plane completely coincidentally on June 29th, 1989, overnight. And we woke up, and the next morning, the streets were empty and there were tanks in the street. And I was 11. And then for a year, so they confiscated everything. They took everything. They took the printing presses. And my mother spent a year, because she's his publisher, she's his printing partner, she's his business partner. She spent a year having to report to national intelligence almost every day. And it's interesting because I think I now see that time through the prism of being an adult. And I just, and also now being a parent myself, but I'm just in awe of her. Every day I remember she still wears national dress. She wears the dob and she covers her head, which she really weaponized against the Islamists, because she was very certain in her faith and who she was. And so this kind of Islamicization, I shouldn't say Islamicization, because it was political Islam. It wasn't Islam as an adherence to a faith. They really saw themselves initially as being like the Iranian revolution, that this was a cultural revolution, this was a reset. And she saw them as Islamofascists. And every morning she would wear a national dress, and she was, I still remember it. She had this little beautiful tan Gucci handbag, because she always looked pristine, and she would wear her gold bangles, and she would go, and they would keep her sometimes till 10, 11 at night. And one of her brothers would go pick her up, and she would come back. And it was this ruse where it was a way of saying that they hadn't jailed her, but she would be gone for hours and hours. And we didn't see him for a year because she wasn't allowed to travel. And he went to Exeter University, where a wonderful friend at the time, Professor Tim Niblock, who is just extraordinary Arabic studies, Middle Eastern studies, one of the founding fathers of a lot of that discipline as we know it, was agreed to be his supervisor. So he retaught himself English and did a PhD. And we stayed. We weren't able to gain permission to join him for another 3 years. 1992. And then he went back in 2001. I think it was my final year at university, because he met the president in Saudi Arabia. He met Omar al-Rashid in Saudi Arabia, and they had split with the more extreme, as it was presented, element of the Islamists at the time. And Bashir told him that there would be freedom of press, and my father went back. And he's extraordinary in that sense. So even now, when this coup happened, his newspaper had been confiscated. The printing license had been confiscated for the last 3 years. And he's in his 70s. He won't quite tell us how old. But we'll
Nor should he.
Nor should he. He's in his 70s. And he is now, the first thing he did was go back to court. So he actually had sued the Islamist regime. He'd been in the process of suing them to get his printing license back. He's just relentless. He's just, him and my mother are, well, him especially, my mother occasionally is just like, are you not tired? But I think that's more, she's like, we have grandchildren now. But she says that to him, I think, in the hope that it'll bring him to his senses. But you could not remove her from his side. And I just, for me, the fact that he is, even now, he's gone back to court, he got his the right to Al-Khartoum back, and he wants to put out a newspaper because he thinks that a functioning democracy requires a functioning press. And I just look at them and I think, there is nothing that I could do that would have entailed as many risks. There is nothing that I could sacrifice, especially now that I have a son, to have done that with four children, to have taken those risks, to have believed so strongly in what we do, and in the need for what we do, that what we do is absolutely the thought of a democracy without a free press is just untenable. And I think this is a lesson that we've had to learn in the US and the UK with these waves of populism. I think we are, you know, for a lot of the general public, when the system works, we're annoying and we're irritating and we're negative. And that's great. That's fine. I have no problem with that. That is the price of entry of a functioning democracy. When the institutions work, the person in the corner kind of jumping up and down going, well, that doesn't work and that doesn't work is annoying. When the institutions don't work, that's when we're most needed.
So journalism was in the blood then. You were never going to open up a chain of garden centres or something like that then. It was inevitable.
I had a place at medical school. My parents did not want me to be a journalist. They are the reason I have a chemistry A level. Thank you, Mum and Bob.
Well, you can't blame them in a sense, can you?
Oh, they were like, oh, no. You need a foundation. You need something to fall back on. And so our deal was that I had to, they had three schools, LSE was one of them, that I had to get into to be allowed to not study medicine. And I had to get the same grades at A-level that I would need to get to study medicine, to be allowed. I think any child of immigrant parents understands that phrase, to be allowed to do what I wanted to do with my life. I had to meet certain metrics. I mean, you know, fair play to them. I was a nightmare. I was a nightmare because I didn't actually want to go to university. I wanted to go to a regional newspaper. What was the point? I only ever wanted to do one thing in my life, and that was be a journalist. Honestly, good for them. Because, you know, my uncle, who's an economist, said to me, as a woman of color, going into these institutions, you need to go in with as much ammunition as you possibly can. And he had worked with the UN, and you know, he had gone through those kind of systems. And he was right. He said, whatever brand name you stamp at the top of that, in terms of the university, he said, you don't have the same freedoms to make those kind of choices.
What were the first steps then? Did you always want to be a television journalist?
No.
Once you'd set out on this sort of the journalism career path, what was the journey?
Oh my gosh. So as a child of print journalists, and I just, you know, printer ink, all of it, it still takes me to a certain place in my childhood. I was really snobbish about TV journalism. It was a complete accident. I went back straight after university because North and South Sudan had signed the first stages of the comprehensive peace agreement, the kind of the agreement to negotiate had been signed. And I thought, well, there's an amazing place to be, right? But also, to be utterly frank with you, I had been rejected from every single apprenticeship and internship scheme. BBC, ITN, Guardian, Financial Times, every single one. And I still don't understand how graduating the year of 9/11 as a fluent Arabic speaker, that happened. I mean, you know, we all know how that happened. But
it's racism, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
they or sexism, or some kind of
both
combination
some kind
of both.
Toxic combination.
Yeah.
They, you know, what they did was take in all these British and American kids who went off to the Middle East post 9/11 and picked up patchy Arabic, and that was more attractive to them. Well, first of all, I think there was this fundamental bias that as a Muslim that somehow there's an inobjectivity inherent in that. As a native Arabic speaker, as a Sunni, as a Muslim, that there was an inobjectivity. As opposed to seeing that access, they saw inobjectivity. Well, you can't possibly tell your story, as if I can tell the story of 1.6 billion Muslims. But yeah, I mean, it is looking back now, I find it extraordinary. And then what I find even more extraordinary is that when my sister graduated from St. Andrews, that she had a repeat of that experience, that she also got turned down from every single internship scheme. So I do feel that lessons were not necessarily learned and I'm 14 years older than you, so that's a lot of time to learn that lesson. But so I just thought, well, then everything here is sending me home. And my parents, again, didn't want me to come home. They wanted me to do a postgrad. And I managed to graduate by the skin of my teeth. I mean, I kind of toyed with the idea of doing, actually, interestingly, it's a broadcast journalism joint master's. between USC, Annenberg, and LSE, which at the time was new and amazing. And my transcript was so embarrassing that they wouldn't, I mean, they wouldn't have let me near the place. So it all kind of conspired to send me home. And also it was where I should have been. So I went home and I worked at Hartle Monitor, which is an English language paper, because at the time my spoken Arabic is great, but the Islamist regime said that you had to pass the press accreditation exam in written Arabic, which was intentional. It was a way of making sure that the Southerners who had been allowed to continue their education in English after the revolution were completely excluded from any of the key institutions and the press and the Southern Sudanese. But my father, I worked there for a while, which was extraordinary because it was confiscated every day. It was like a baptism of fire. It was the editor was this absolute firebrand Southern Sudanese journalist. I mean, so I went from my lovely flat in Clerkenwell, St. John's Square, walking into the LSE every morning to literally being raided at the Khartoum Monitor every night. And it was just this baptism of fire. And then my father, the French prime minister at the time, I think was De Villepin. Anyway, don't quote me on that. But he arrived and my father, his editor, who sadly passed away recently and was a titan of Sudanese journalism, was a poet and a revolutionary and something out of a book, Fadlallah Muhammad. The most terrifying, you know, he's like one of those editors in a story about journalism. He doesn't need to shout because he just looks at you and you know that you are not only unfit to grace his presence, but you're unfit to be part of the legacy of journalism that in any way involves him. And how could you possibly be so stupid? But so he said to Baba, we don't have any English speakers, because that was part of the Cultural Revolution, was that they stopped English language lessons in schools as part of the Arabization. So we don't have any English speakers and your daughter speaks fluent English. Bring her here. I've got someone who will train her up. And you know, and I was 22, so an idiot. I was like, I don't want to train at my father's newspaper. And my father was like, I recall being the person who paid for your education. So you're going to go train at my newspaper.
Yeah, he had some say.
Yeah, he was like, ooh, I remember paying in sterling for your education. So you're going home. And it was amazing. It was amazing because we had a national intelligence censor in the newsroom. And also I was not a product of Sudanese journalism in the sense that I hadn't gone to journalism school. I didn't understand the system. So I didn't understand when I was breaking the rules. So one of the key rebels in the South, Yasser Arman, is Northern of origin. And so he was someone that the Northern government had a particular hatred of and was banned from appearing in any Northern press. And I was interviewing him every day and I was like thinking to myself, why is nobody interviewing Yasser Arman? I mean, seems like an open goal, but hey, you know, with the arrogance of youth, I was like, well, maybe I'm the only one who's thought of it. Then we got raided and I was told in no uncertain terms that I was a reason nobody else was doing it. But it also was just really great because my father's best advice to me was always the worst red lines are the ones that they put in your head. The worst censor is the censor that they put in your head. And that's what you can never allow happen. And so you constantly have to, and that's whether it's your self-saboteur, whether it's the critic in the newsroom, whether it's the critic on social media, the moment that you let that person into your head, that's the moment that you lose what makes your journalism worthwhile.
Where's the first place you want to travel to report from when the lockdown is lifted?
Oh, gosh. Afghanistan.
Why?
there is so much that happens under cover of these kind of moments. We already knew that the peace deal, if I can still call it that, was on shaky ground. We already knew that a lot of the work that should have been done in terms of bringing in the different parts of the Afghan civil society, the Afghan population. It just feels like Afghanistan is somewhere where bad things are gonna happen because the US wants to get out so quickly. There's just a real discomfort for me around the rising civilian death toll, around the ways in which, again, what is being privileged is the needs of a specific number. I find Afghanistan incredibly worrying. Saying that, though, I mean, that's just kind of with my investigations hat on. Saying that, I think realistically, where I will probably want to go, given where we will be in terms of the life cycle of the disease, is either Yemen or somewhere in Africa. I think that's where it would be most useful for me to go.
Nirma, well, it's been a hugely interesting conversation. Thank you ever so much for your time. I find what you do, the work that you're doing, incredibly inspirational, and I hope that you can keep it up and go on to even greater heights. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Paul.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.